From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a Supreme Court death and drama, hot politics in South Carolina, Nevada, the Pope versus Donald Trump, Apple and the government square off over privacy and security. Conservative Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia dead at 79, and Republicans immediately calling for President Obama not to touch that seat. The president says it's his constitutional duty.
The president of the United States is to nominate someone. The Senate is to consider that nomination.
Pope Francis, headed home from Mexico, appeared to call out Donald Trump's plan to build a wall and Trump's Christian faith.
A person who thinks only about building walls, wherever they may be, and not of building bridges, is not a Christian.
From the campaign trail in South Carolina, Donald Trump shot back.
For a religious leader to question a person's faith is disgraceful.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Heidi Prisbella of USA Today, Olivier Knox of Yahoo News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Should the president roll on with his plans to nominate, how do you read Trump versus the Pope, the state of the 2016 races? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, Heidi Prisbella, senior political reporter at USA Today. Heidi, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also in Washington, Olivier Knox is with us, chief Washington correspondent for Yahoo News. Olivier, welcome. Great to have you.
Thanks, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty is here. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Heidi, and Olivier.
Boy, have we got a lot to look at this week. Let's dive right in. Antonin Scalia, of course, sharp-tongued conservative stalwart of the court, longest-serving justice there, dead at 79 at a luxury hunting ranch near the Mexican border. And immediately, we had Republicans saying President Obama should not name his replacement. Here was Rubio, Marco Rubio, senator, on Sunday.
The next president should have a chance to fill that void, not someone who's never going to answer to the electorate again.
Okay. Chuck Grassley, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said maybe we could hold hearings, but he didn't sound too enthusiastic either. Here's Grassley.
This is a very serious position to fill, and it should be filled and debated during the campaign and filled by either Hillary Clinton, Senator Sanders, or whoever is nominated by the Republicans.
Ranking Democrat on that committee, Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, saying, are you kidding? It's the president's job to go ahead and nominate.
It would be totally irresponsible and totally unprecedented to not allow a hearing and a vote on a nominee.
Olivier Knox, how do you see this unfolding? Grassley seemed to say, well, maybe we'll have hearings, but lots of Republicans said, no, it should be the next president. Do you see Republicans at this week's end digging in on this, or does it look like that may make them look obstructionist, even non-constitutional?
Well, the first shot fired in this battle came from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, mm-hmm. who sort of drew a line in the sand saying that the vacancy should not be filled by Barack Obama. He did not say will, though, and people in Washington are watching that carefully because he left a little bit of room there. Initially, Republican presidential candidates and Republicans in the Senate said he's right, but we've seen some wavering since then. And so it's not completely clear yet. You know, Chuck Grassley, for example, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman that we just heard from, has been shifting a little bit on this. We've seen a couple of Senate Republicans, vulnerable Senate Republicans who are up for election in November, waver as well. So I don't know that the political fight over this, I don't think the battle lines have been completely set yet.
Heidi, how do you read this first reaction saying, no, President Obama, do not think of nominating a replacement here? And yet the Constitution's clear on this. Presidents nominate and the Senate has advice and consent role here. Is this a pure muscle play by Republicans who don't want to lose that conservative seat, don't want to see President Obama put up the Scalia successor?
Honestly, I was pretty surprised by the fact that he was so firm about it and did it so quickly.
But if you look
at the kind of the position that this man has been in politically throughout the course of his career, and even just more recently in the past several years, which is that, you know, the Republicans have gotten battered within their own party by the Tea Party and conservatives who say that they haven't been willing to stand up to Democrats and to fight the good fight, so to say, on numerous issues that have been through Congress. And for them, this is going to be a critical issue. We're talking about, you know, potentially impact for 30 years here on the court. So I think he is responding to that. In the past cycle in 2014, they effectively neutralized a lot of these challenges within the party. From the Tea Party, they didn't have some of the more strident, you know, Sharon Angles and Christine O'Donnells cropping up. They kind of like neutralized that a bit. So I think he was thinking about it politically in that sense that, oh, we don't want, you know, going to the cycle, our first concern is battening down that kind of rebellion within our party. But longer term, I think that's why you're seeing, like Olivia remarked, that they're kind of backtracking a little bit just because they also have to be concerned not just about these challenges, but about what happens with the six Republicans who are up in these states that Obama carried twice. Because when you look at the public polling right now, the public's very divided on this. As you would expect, Democrats think that someone should be nominated. Republicans think someone shouldn't. But independents haven't made up their minds yet. So as this drags out, I wouldn't be surprised to see, Hillary Clinton, the other Democrats making a huge issue out of this and making the Republicans look like they're being obstructionist. And we all know, going back to the history of the shutdown, how devastating that was when Republicans were seen as being obstructionist. So this has many, many more parts to play out. And I think that ultimately McConnell has to be sensitive to where the public goes on this, because, like I said, the independents have not made up their minds.
Bernie Sanders ready to talk about it right away. Here he was on Monday in Michigan.
You talk about the Constitution a whole lot. Well, how about obeying the Constitution and start holding hearings when President Obama nominates the next Supreme Court justice?
But Ted Cruz, Senator, ready to go right to that Tea Party line as well. Here he was with Chuck Todd on NBC's Meet the Press.
We're going to have an election, and if liberals are so confident that the American people want unlimited abortion on demand, want religious liberty torn down, want the Second Amendment taken away, want veterans' memorials torn down, want the crosses and stars of David sandblasted off of the tombstones of our fallen veterans, then go and make the case to the people. I don't think the American people want that.
Sandblasting crosses off of tombstones? I have no idea where he gets that, Jack. But what do you hear in this standoff over Scalia? His legacy and the seat he occupied going forward. Not his seat, but the seat he occupied.
Well, it's going to be it's a decisive seat. I mean, so many of these 5-4 cases, there was just one, in fact, days before Justice Scalia died, where the Obama administration's EPA regulations were essentially put on hold, stayed by the court. If he hadn't been the sitting justice, then it could have gone the other way. So the stakes couldn't be larger. And what strikes me about the McConnell opening position, I guess I take it as that, is its gratuitousness. Because the Republicans, it's assumed that they will vote against whoever the nominee is. And thanks to Chuck Schumer, who made this one of the criterion, it is quite all right to vote against justices who are impeccably well qualified, but whose ideology you disagree with. That would describe almost any person that the president would submit. So, of course, some people say, well, what happens if they submit somebody who's been approved for an appeals court case by an overwhelming Republican vote? That still doesn't matter, I don't think, for the Republicans, because they can say, well, the appeal court is one thing, the Supreme Court is something else. Ideology is decisive. We're voting on it. That's accepted. Chuck Schumer said it was, and now our people will be happy by turning to and the Constitution, and the forms of civility between the branches would be observed. The president would nominate. The Supreme Court would not give its consent. I mean, the Congress would not give its consent.
What a picture. Polarization is so great that you can't even get into the process potentially here. And the sense, that this is supposed to be carved in stone forever? Let's go right to our listeners. So many on this front. Steve in Danbury, Wisconsin. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think you used the language that the Republicans don't want to lose this conservative seat. And I'm sitting here thinking the notion that any seat on the Supreme Court belongs to one political party or the other is just absurd. So that's my comment.
I mean, I'm with you, and they've changed a lot over the years. I mean, Olivier, you know, the 5-4 this way or that is certainly not carved in stone and certainly has changed in the past.
That's at the core of this fight over filling the seat that Scalia occupied. It would, you know, we've had so many 5-4 decisions on so many momentous issues. Conservatives have been very concerned about seeing this seat, not just the seat, but the overall balance of the court tip towards the more liberal wing. That's absolutely 100% at the core of this fight.
Of course, it tipped to the conservative side not so many years ago. It's happened plenty before. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on the air.
Absolutely. You have all this populist uprising in America right now. With the way the country is going, it's perceived to be going, and it's, you know, that's under Republican rules. And I have to say, you know, all these Republicans, especially the politicians, what has been a part of their stump speech here lately over the past 20 years is the little pocket constitution that they love to pull out on camera that they can, you know, they keep with them. Maybe they need to read those things and realize, you know, the presidency, you know, you're there for 4 years, or unless you're impeached, or unless you resign, or God forbid you die in office, not for 3 years, not for 2 years, not for 2.5 years. So for them to constitutionally say that the president can't be allowed to nominate anyone, let alone have a hearing, it's baffling to me, and I would hope that it'd be baffling to the American public to put enough pressure on these guys to bow down, and I think this will cost them the Senate.
Carl, we've got it. I don't think it's constitutional. I think it's something else entirely here. It's politics, and pretty straightforwardly, politics and power. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Looking at a week in the news, Justice Antonin Scalia's death and what comes next. Political battles in South Carolina, Nevada coming right up this weekend. Donald Trump versus Pope Francis, that was something else. And Apple versus the U.S. government, of course, on privacy and security. Olivier Knox is with us, chief Washington correspondent for Yahoo News. Heidi Prisbella is with us, senior political reporter at USA Today. Jack Beatty is here, and you can join us. What do you think? Does the Republican call for President Obama not to nominate Scalia's successor make sense? Make any sense? Who's looking good in South Carolina? Trump, Cruz, Rubio in Nevada, Clinton, Sanders? Who's right, Trump or the Pope? But here we are. Sam in Newton, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wonder what would happen if one of the other Supreme Justices was to either retire or die, maybe one or two or three more. We know that people are not getting younger in the Supreme Court. Would the conservatives continue saying, no, let's just wait? Don't we have a functioning Supreme Court in this country that is just ridiculous? Everybody concentrates in Scalia, but I think we should talk about the broader sense and see what would the case be and how the candidates think about it.
Well, so Sam, I understand exactly what you're saying. I mean, we did hear this week from retired Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, of course, named by Ronald Reagan in 1981. Here she was talking with Fox News' Troy Hayden in Arizona.
When you hear, say, one side saying that they'd like to wait till the next president is in office to appoint a justice, what do you think about that?
I don't agree. I think we need somebody there now to do the job, and let's get on with it.
Senator Day O'Connor says, get on with it. Heidi, if it were the other way around, a Republican president in office, and, you know, this kind of a late-term nomination opportunity, do you think they would just say, oh, no, I'll pass on that and let the next president do it?
Well, I think we know the answer to that one. But I think, you know, the question does raise an interesting point, which is that if this game of chicken in the end could really backfire, and that is that if Republicans and Democrats both make this election strongly about a referendum on the court, And Republicans make good on their promise to either, you know, vote someone down or just gum up the process. Mm-hmm. Let's say Hillary Clinton gets into the White House. Does she then feel emboldened to appoint someone who would have otherwise, if Obama had done it? I think the conditions right now are the thinking is that he'd have to pick someone who would be so clearly non-ideological that the Republicans would look bad and would have to like put this person through. But if it becomes a referendum, then does the new president, if it's a Democrat, feel emboldened to appoint someone who is seen as more polarizing or ideological in that regard? And God forbid, if like the caller said, another justice, something happens, then you have a second opening that the president is filling with another person who Republicans would feel strongly, more strongly about.
Yeah, Olivier, Ted Cruz is right in a way. There are big stakes here. The way he put it, I don't understand, but there are big stakes here. Do you see, can or will President Obama nominate someone who would shift the philosophical profile of the court, the philosophical balance of the court, given the circumstances in which that's going to be happening?
Yes, of course. Of course he could.
And get them through? Or is that at this point, I think, a futile gesture?
Well, I don't know about futile. I mean, there are two sort of, to think in crass political terms, there are two prizes here. One is changing the ideological balance of the court, right, if he nominates someone who gets through. The other is inflicting as much political pain on the Republicans as possible via this process. So if you assume that he's not going to get someone through, and I think that's a relatively safe assumption, then why not pick somebody who's very hard to reject on other grounds? Why not nominate someone who is, I don't know, I'm thinking hypothetically here, but there is active talk right now about, look, so what happens if he nominates a minority who's already been confirmed by a lopsided margin in the Senate? What happens then? To your point about Cruz, but not understanding Ted Cruz's point, I'm fascinated to watch Ted Cruz on this because he's on the Senate Judiciary Committee. He would get an enormous role in questioning whomever the president nominates. But instead, he's chosen to recast this race in what we used to call the culture wars. And I think that's really fascinating to watch. It was going to be always in the back, lurking in the back of everyone's mind. Everyone talks about the hypothetical possibility of three vacancies on the court for the next president. Now, all of a sudden, it's not abstract. It's concrete. And the way he's framing it is very interesting. It's clear that he sees an enormous advantage to reframing this in this old model of culture wars.
Jack, how do you see this unfolding? I mean, no one can know, but here we are, and the president says he's going to go ahead. The Republicans are saying, oh, we may not even entertain it. We may entertain it, but gum it up. How does this unfold?
Well, I think it becomes a drama of base politics. Each party will go to the base assume there are hearings and assume the Republicans can ask tough questions. Those will be directed precisely at their base. Heidi posited the independent out there who will be offended, and surely such people exist. The Concord Monitor, the state paper here, hit hard at Kelly Ayotte, the Republican and senator from New Hampshire, because she gave initial support to this idea the president shouldn't nominate anyone at all. And they said, wait a minute, that's not how the Constitution would work. That speaks for the independent. However, the independent is an increasingly rare bird in American politics, the pure independent. And increasingly, parties pay, they go right at the base. And this Supreme Court issue is a base mobilizing issue for both sides. So I look for maximum political damage either way. And forgetting about the middle, I don't think that's going to be on with the Supreme Court.
Let's go to Penny in Hammond, Louisiana. Penny, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes,
I'm calling in regard to the Supreme Court seat. That I think that it is a blatant disregard to the president as well as to the American people to think that he should not nominate someone for that seat. And I think that the Republicans are doing what they've done for the last seven and a half years, just blatantly disregard anything that the president brings, whether it be again good for the people or just not giving the American people an opportunity to be served to the fullest extent of the law as we've been promised to be.
Penny, let me ask you, you politely used the word disregard. Do you mean disrespect?
Absolutely, absolutely. One in the same. Disregard, disrespect, and to hide behind what they believe the American people want to wait till next term, I think that's ludicrous. I think that's absolutely ludicrous. And if it was a Republican in office, we would be laughed at as Democrats or any other party to suggest such a thing.
Penny, I appreciate your call. Not by any means the only person this week who I've heard articulate that this looks like an example of disrespect for a sitting president. We are going to see how all this works out. So many remarkable interactions and exchanges this week. Of course, the Pope in Mexico, a big visit there, and then mass right at the Mexican border with the United States in Ciudad Juarez in Mexico. Here's a little bit from his homily addressing what he called the humanitarian crisis south of the border that he said has led to mass migration.
Esta tragedia humana que representa la migración forzada.
The Pope saying there, the human tragedy that forced migration represents is a global phenomenon. This crisis can be measured in numbers and statistics. We want to measure it with names and stories and families. And then that amazing statement on his way back to Rome. We heard it at the top of the show. A person who thinks only about building walls, wherever they may be, and not of building bridges is not a Christian. And the next thing you know, we see the headlines, New York Times, Pope says Trump is not a Christian. Donald Trump firing back very hot on that. Here he was on the campaign trail in South Carolina yesterday, Donald Trump.
If and when the Vatican is attacked by ISIS, which as everyone knows is ISIS's ultimate trophy, I can promise you that the Pope would have only wished and prayed that Donald Trump would have been president.
Okay, well, now we should say today you've got a spokesman for the Pope on Vatican Radio saying, oh, no, this wasn't about any particular person, not in any way a personal attack or indication of who to vote for. The Pope's clearly said he didn't want to get involved in the electoral campaign in the U.S. A little late for that in many ways. Heidi, first of all, what do you make of the Pope's statement and then the way it is likely to be playing out right now in American politics at such a crucial time?
Well, to give that statement just a little bit of credibility, I did look at the full remarks. These remarks were made by the Pope on a plane on his way back. And I believe the context of the question was that Donald Trump has called Mexicans rapists and murderers. And the Pope said, if someone uses language like that, that's not Christian. And then he also did say, you know, about the wall. He didn't specifically say Trump, but we all know.
No, but he was hardly missing words. A person who thinks only about building walls, wherever they may be, and not a building bridge, is not a Christian. This guy can think on his feet. That's not out of nowhere.
I don't think it's as shocking that the Pope said what he said, because he's shown that he's willing to kind of be very out front on political issues like the environment and make, you know, provocative statements. But what's more surprising was Trump, even by Trump standards, to come out and say what he did about the Pope. And I think today I saw in a town hall he's kind of backtracking a little bit, because I just don't see any political benefit for him to be in an argument with the Pope like this. I just, you know, there's already people in his party, I think, who feel a little bit, you know, irked by some of the comments that the Pope has made about the environment and when he came here, you know, to the U.S. But I don't think it hurts Trump necessarily, but it also doesn't help him.
Jack, I mean, we heard Pope. We heard Donald Trump saying, you know, for a religious leader to question a person's faith is disgraceful. Who else, if not a religious leader, to raise questions about faith, or in this case, Christianity?
Yes, but, you know, when you attack me, Trump says, I slang you back. If you praise me, Putin, I'll praise you back. You know, there was a sentence in the New York Times in the same week that he, you know, got embroiled with the Pope. He said favorable things about Saddam Hussein. But, you know, in his audacity of utterance, I think really people look beyond the content and say, this guy speaks his mind. He's not politic. He's not constrained. There's an honesty there, even if it looks to other people like total recklessness. And by the way, you know, in an interview last night, he made much of the Vatican having walls around it. And somebody pointed out today, Josh Marshall, that those walls, in fact, were built in 846 after Muslim raiders tore up St. Peter's Basilica. Don't tell Trump that.
I mean, this is a pope who speaks his mind. Corey in Buffalo, New York. Corey, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Trump isn't saying close the borders to everyone that wants to get into the United States. He's trying to provide national security by keeping out the illegals. And a lot of the terrorists are sneaking in illegally. And, you know, I am a devout Christian and very conservative, and I've got to say, to the Pope, there is a line in the Bible that says, he who is without sin, cast the first stone. I'm sorry, the Pope is nothing more than a man. He's an emissary. He's not God.
Yeah, but still, he's a pretty high, if he's a man, he's pretty high in the hierarchy of thinking about what Christianity means. I mean, let's see. Corey, you know, Donald Trump, I've heard him. I've been in his rallies. He's talking about keeping out a lot of Mexicans, not just Texan terrorists, and the Pope is saying, be compassionate. Is there room for that at the border, Corey?
We can be compassionate and still allow them in legally. We're worried about, okay, there's a big talk on illegal Mexicans and the like coming into this country and taking our low-paying jobs. Okay, I have no problem with them coming in and taking our jobs. No American really wants to do. No problem at all with that. My problem is all these illegals are coming in. They don't have to pay all these taxes that the rest of us do, yet they're still getting the health care. They're still getting education. They're still getting, you know, they have a kid here.
Well, I hear you, but the
That's
Pope might say many do pay taxes, and the Pope might say pass an immigration package so that they're legalized, and then they will pay taxes.
And if they come in legally, I have no issues with that.
Yeah, no, the tension in this is just as high as it can be. I mean, Heidi, you're chiming in there on the tax front.
Well, but that because it's been proven actually to be the opposite, that they pay taxes. A lot of them wind up paying our taxes, but they don't reap the benefits because they're not citizens. So that's actually the opposite. And especially with people who are going to be collecting Social Security, really need to think hard about this, because a lot of the people coming in are younger and they create a bigger tax base for the older people who are then going to be collecting on those benefits. But another comment, you know, I just wonder about some of the statements that are being made from people who are listening to the campaign rhetoric. For example, a lot of the terrorists are sneaking in illegally. I don't know of any terrorists in this country who've been apprehended who've snuck in illegal.
Yep.
That's just not an accurate statement. And secondly, when you look at some of the statistics, immigration is grinding to a halt on the Mexican border. You know, so that's just another, you know, falsehood. And then I would wonder how Corey feels about the fact that, you know, Donald Trump has used footage, from Morocco, of people running across a border that isn't even the Mexican border.
Yeah, very prominently, and it had to backpedal on the factual quality there. I mean, Olivia, you got David Brooks in the New York Times today saying, look, the real threat is not at the border. The real threat is people spending time tracking down people who want to be gardeners, and pointing out that this is a kind of an issue of the 1980s and 90s and years back. As Heidi says, the flow is not so great now, but this is about older white Americans just feeling uncomfortable with the browning of this country, Olivier.
Well, you know, there are a couple of really interesting things here. One is the notion that Trump is a bold, brash speaker of his opinion. I was really struck by the fact that he read his statement of response to the Pope.
In particular, the one on ISIS wanting to take the Vatican by storm.
Right, right. Yeah. So I thought that was – he said that before, by the way. He said that like 6 months ago. But I thought it was interesting.
It wasn't off the cuff.
It suggested that he was aware that there was a political danger here, that he was on shifting terrain. The other thing is people talk about the Pope said this about Trump and Trump hit back. Actually, Trump launched the first shot of this fight on February 11th in an interview on Fox News when he basically said the Pope should stay out of the debate over immigration policy. So the notion that this is a, you know, a Vatican first strike is not correct. But, you know, this is about economic anxiety, and that's going to be a huge issue in November.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, 28 people were killed in a bombing targeting military and defense officials in Ankara, Turkey on Wednesday. Turkish President Erdogan pointed at Kurdish groups, including those in Syria, backed by the United States, as BBC reporter Yolanda Nell.
Officials say the suicide attacker was a Syrian Kurd from the YPG militia, and despite denials, that he worked with a Kurdish group in Turkey, the PKK.
Watch that space. In Southern California, state officials confirmed yesterday that the Porter Ranch natural gas leak has been sealed after spewing gas for almost 4 months, sickening, displacing thousands of residents. Here's resident Mac Bacuco.
There's still people getting sick. They've been getting sick since even when it's been capped off like a week ago.
And Taylor Swift's 1989 won Album of the Year at the Grammys on Monday, making her the first woman to win the award twice. In her acceptance speech, she appeared to send a message to Kanye West, who's been taking credit for her success.
If you just focus on the work and you don't let those people sidetrack you, someday when you get where you're going, you'll look around and you will know that it was you and the people who love you who put you there.
And more news as we speak today that Harper Lee, author of To Kill a Mockingbird, has died at age 89 in her hometown of Monroe, made famous in To Kill a Mockingbird. Harper Lee, dead at 89. Olivia Knox is with us from Yahoo News. Heidi Presbella with us from USA Today. Jack Beatty's here. And you can join us on the 2016 primary races and what we're likely to see this weekend in South Carolina for the Republicans, in Nevada for the Democrats. How about Apple and the FBI, the court order saying unlock that phone? Of course, this is the phone in the San Bernardino case. Very hot issue there. Apple pushing back hard on that. Are you watching China's missiles in the South China Sea? U.S. airstrikes in Libya? That big bombing in Turkey? Very, very tough politics in South Carolina this week. On Wednesday, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley and Florida Senator Marco Rubio were with Fox's Greta Van Susteren. Here's Nikki Haley explaining why she had decided to endorse Rubio.
Marco Rubio is the person that we need as president. He's got the fight to really go to Washington and actually see action happen. He's got the passion that we love in South Carolina, and he's got the conviction. And at the end of the day, that's what we want. That's who South Carolinians care about. He's got the conviction to go there and do the right thing.
The very popular Republican governor of South Carolina, Jeb Bush, had hoped for that endorsement. He did not get it. Heidi, how do you see this race shaping up in South Carolina?
You know, I thought that was... There's many people talking about this as kind of a race for second place, because even though we've seen some polls suggesting Donald Trump has slipped a bit in South Carolina and nationally, I would be very surprised if he doesn't pull out a win there. So then the question is, who's battling and who's going to win second? And that, I think, is very consequential for two people, for Ted Cruz, because his path to victory very much depends on the South and runs through the South. So he's got a lot invested in here. That's why you saw him putting on this press conference spectacle about deposing Donald Trump the other day. Mm. But also for Jeb Bush, because I just kind of feel like we may be at the terminal point after that Nikki Haley endorsement, because, you know, the Bushes did a lot to try and get her to back Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush was one of her early supporters, so I think that was a particularly debilitating blow. And then when you look at just nationally what's going on with his numbers, you know, polling 1% in Nevada, I think that if what we're expecting to happen happens, which is that he comes in pretty low out of South Carolina, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on Jeb to get out. And then I think, you know, the race is really a three-man race. And going on from there, as long as it is a three-man race, that benefits Donald Trump. Because I think that the other two are, you know, kind of consolidating the establishment and the conservative side of the vote, but that's still not enough to contend with what is an increasingly higher ceiling for Donald Trump. You know, we thought his ceiling was at 30%. Now we're seeing he's up to 40% in national polls. So I think that, you know, there's still going to be a push to continue winnowing and weeding out this field, because the longer Trump goes on, like he's saying in his own words, you know, he becomes unstoppable, inevitable.
The Bush family turning out in force to try and rally for Jeb. It was a tough, tough job, though. It was former president, his younger brother, George W. Bush, at a rally for Jeb in North Charleston, South Carolina. This was on Monday, saying Jeb won't just, you know, vent, but he'll actually fix the problems.
We do not need someone in the Oval Office who mirrors and inflames our anger and frustration. We need someone who can fix the problems that cause our anger and frustration, and that's Jeb Bush.
Jack Beatty, that was a very interesting moment from George W. Bush. Of course, yes, he took the country to war. Yes, he was the leader after 9/11. But he was always very careful to take an embracing tone and message toward minorities, including religious minorities and Muslims in America and more. It seemed to be a shot at Mr. Trump right there.
Yes, a noble utterance, I thought, from the former president. And you're right, that was one of his accomplishments as president. I think shortly after 9/11, he went to a mosque. And, of course, President Obama didn't do that until, what, last week or so. You know, at that rally, it sort of underlined Jeb's poignant situation there. The Financial Times interviewed 23 voters who were there. Only three were committed to Jeb. Most were really tilting to Trump. In New Hampshire, Jeb told an audience, "I was there, please clap." And he hit that same, you know, importunate note in South Carolina this week. He said to one group, "I hope you don't think the end is near." This is not the way a winning campaign sounds. This is not the sound of a winning campaign.
And of course, Trump and Cruz going at it hard in South Carolina. Ted Cruz has pulled ahead in some, at least one national poll now, but Donald Trump still with a lead in South Carolina. Here he was in Hanahan, South Carolina, on Monday, attacking Ted Cruz.
I think he's a very unstable guy. And I must tell you one thing about Ted Cruz that I can say that only to a minor extent by comparison for the other politicians. I haven't been doing this long. I've been in it since June 16th. But I will tell you, I have never, ever met a person that lies more than Ted Cruz.
And Ted Cruz, well, Donald Trump threatening to sue Cruz over a television ad there that showed him from some years back with a pro-choice position on abortion. Donald Trump threatening suit. Here was Cruz punching back in Seneca, South Carolina on Wednesday.
You know, I have to say to Mr. Trump, you have been threatening frivolous lawsuits for your entire adult life. Even in the annals of frivolous lawsuits, this takes the cake. So, Donald, I would encourage you, if you want to file a lawsuit challenging this ad, claiming it is defamation, file the lawsuit.
Olivier Knox, if it's a three-way race coming out of South Carolina, how do you we'll look at the Democrats. How do you see this shaping up?
Well, on the Republican side, this is the biggest test yet for Trump's unorthodox campaign. He does have the poll numbers on his side. The question is whether that's going to translate into actual votes. It has in the past in one case, and it fell short in Iowa. That's going to be very interesting. The danger for the other Republicans is that the more he does well, the more people give him a second look, the more people start to come to grips or come to terms with his candidacy. The most important number for Donald Trump this whole cycle has been the number of Republican voters who say they could never, ever imagine supporting him as the nominee. I think it got as high as 66% last year. It has been dropping, although it depends on which poll you look at. That's the most important thing for him right now. In terms of a two-man race, I think Heidi has already laid out exactly sort of the problems for people like Jeb, people like Ben Carson, who, if they don't do well in South Carolina, are going to be under a fair amount of pressure to leave the field. Every day brings a new story about Jeb's big donors anonymously or sometimes not anonymously saying, you know, it's time to turn out the lights and cede the field. On the Democratic side, I was an early Bernie watcher. I'm a Vermonter. I'm familiar with Bernie's public life. And when he announced, I took it seriously because everybody in Vermont knows He's not actually a rumpled professorial figure who shouts himself hoarse in with a sort of a New York accent. He is a very organized politician with a very impressive messaging apparatus. At one point, he had better social media penetration than this White House has. Mm-hmm. But that didn't trickle down to Brooklyn, Hillary Clinton's headquarters, because they laughed him off for the first months of the campaign. Well, they're not laughing now.
I guess not.
No, they're not. And they really shouldn't. And in fact, you're seeing sort of a frantic activity now on the Hillary camp. They had dismissed his showings in the polls, and then they shifted to this new argument, which was, well, all right, he's going to do fine in Iowa and New Hampshire, where the voter base isn't that diverse. As soon as he gets to these bigger states where Latinos and African Americans have greater electoral weight, he's going to fail. Well, what you're seeing now is Bernie is drawn some pretty important endorsements, including that of the former NAACP head, Ben Jealous. I still think this is a tough one for him. I still think that Nevada and South Carolina are going to be really hard for Bernie Sanders, but they're not going to be as hard as the Hillary campaign wanted them to be 6 months ago.
Here he was. This was with the MSNBC last night. Took a question from a Muslim American doctor worried about the safety of his kids and given what he described as an uptick in Islamophobia. Here's Bernie Sanders.
It is absolutely unacceptable to me that in the year 2016, we have people like Donald Trump and others who are trying to gain votes by scapegoating people who may be Muslims or people who may be Latinos. That is unacceptable.
Unacceptable. Latinos right in there. Of course, Nevada, they're a significant voting bloc. Hillary Clinton also paying close attention on that front as well. In her town hall appearance last night, moderator Jose Diaz-Balart, news anchor Telemundo, asked her if she would promise to deal with immigration reform within her first 100 days in office.
We're going to introduce legislation, Jose. We are absolutely going to introduce legislation. I'm going to call everybody on the committee, Democrats and Republicans alike.
Within 100 days.
Yeah, I'm going to introduce my priority legislation, and this is at the top of that list.
Jack, can you hear a candidate who's wound up and focused on that front?
Well, Nevada was supposed to be Clinton country, part of her firewall. And as recently as October, Sanders had no staff person there. Now he has more than – he has 22 state – he has 11 state offices to 7 for hers. And, you know, why? Well, one reason, unemployment in Nevada is 7.1%. And Nevada was ground zero for the housing crash. Many people are still underwater on their mortgages. There is a lot of economic suffering there, and Sanders is appealing to that and saying, I'm the guy for that. Meanwhile, the Hillary people who were talking up the ethnic variety of Nevada when they were saying it was their firewall. Now, one of her spokespersons was saying, well, really, the people that show up at the caucuses, they're really like Iowa people. They're white liberals. Well, in 2008, 35% of the people who showed up at the caucuses were minorities. So now they're shifting their rationale even about it and claiming it's not such a diverse state. It's going to be a much closer race than anybody would have imagined just a month ago when Hillary had a double-digit lead there.
Heidi, help us with the politics on another front here, the politics of President Obama headed to Cuba next month. The announcement just out this week, first visit by an American president to Cuba in 80 years or so. How does that play? Does it help the Democrats come the fall? Cruz and Rubio, both with Cuban heritage, are saying don't do it.
Well, that's what they've been saying all along. And I think, honestly, this is less about 2016 politics than it is about the president, as his spokesman said the other day, trying to make this policy, this new warming of relations with Cuba, quote, irreversible, because the president knows that should a Republican come into office, we still have the main parts of our policy against Cuba in terms of the economic embargo still in place. And it would be very, it would be somewhat easy for that president to just to reverse everything that he's done. Although, you know, closing, opening up an embassy is a lot easier than closing it. That's kind of a hostile act. But at the same time, I think the president wants to come down there and show that he's also pushing for additional reforms and to do everything that he can to make sure that this remains part of his legacy.
And Olivier, this Apple versus the courts, Apple versus the FBI, of course, this is the telephone in the San Bernardino shooting case. They want to get in there and figure out if anybody else was involved. If so, who? They say this is an ongoing threat. They can't do it. It's encrypted. Apple says, no, if we open that up, it opens the way for all encryption and privacy to be lost here. The court is ordering them to do it. Google, Microsoft now coming down on Apple's side in this. Do they ultimately get forced by the courts, Olivier? Where do we go?
Well, I feel like we've come full circle in our conversation today because there's a very real likelihood that if Apple follows through on its promise to challenge this, this could end up all the way up at the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
A couple of notes. One is that, you know, Apple has sort of finally discovered the merits of this kind of privacy argument. For years, they cooperated with law enforcement. For years, they agreed to unlock phones. They're taking a line on this one. It's a very interesting case. The FBI is looking to set a precedent here. They've invoked a 200-year-old law to do this, but they want to use that going forward, and they want to set a precedent that would let them essentially coerce tech companies to do this in the future. So this is a really interesting argument. I have been told by people who know this better than I do that there's a really strong chance this goes all the way up to the top, in which case we may be looking at a 4-4 court. I mean, this is a completely fascinating moment in the court's history and in the fight over security versus privacy.
Digital privacy people saying if you force Apple to do this, if the U.S. government does that, then you can count on China asking for and exploiting the same thing, Russia asking for and exploiting the same thing, and of course, lots of others here. Jack, Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance saying yesterday he has 175 Apple devices sitting in his cybercrime lab waiting to be unlocked. If there's a precedent set, there are a lot of other dominoes ready to fall right there.
There's a wall that's coming down.
We'll see. We'll see. We'll see where Silicon Valley versus the courts versus the FBI ends up. What a week. Olivier Knox with Yahoo News, thank you so much for joining us today. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Tom.
And Heidi Prisbella, senior political reporter at USA Today. Thank you so much, Heidi.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, thank you as always, sir.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.